So today we are joining St. Paul in Athens. Has anyone been to Athens? Yep. And we're talking about where to look for God and where not to look for God and what God wants from us. So we're in Athens in the year AD 51 during Paul's first missionary journey west. He's geographically in Europe. And he's got a very big challenge ahead of him. He is learning to reach pagan Gentiles with the story of a Jewish Messiah as the crucified, resurrected, and ascended Son of God and Savior of the world. Anyone who thinks they are good at communications, there's a challenge to get that very Jewish story across to pagan Greeks. If you're into NT Wright, he's opening this up beautifully at the moment in many ways. It's not going to be easy. Now, the backstory that so speaks to me is that he gets to Athens, and of course, there are circumstances why he's there, and it's part of his travel logistics. And he spends 3 days on the ground doing local research. He reconnoiters. He's not like so many preachers who just get off the plane and 2 hours later are speaking at some packed church. No, he has gone around, spoken to people, looked at things, done his cultural hermeneutic. I love it when I go to a city. I look at the buildings. I usually visit the cathedral if it's a historic city. I go to a few cafes. You find yourself talking to people. Within hours, you start to get a sense of this place and its distinctives. You're contrasting it to what your normal is. Well, Paul spent 3 days doing that. And he meets Jews, he talks with people in the marketplace. And then after 3 days, he gets invited to this special place where new ideas and philosophies and such like put out there, a bit like Hyde Park in London, if you know that place. Anyone can stump up and have a say. I think the modern equivalent are TED Talks. Who's familiar with TED Talks? Okay, yeah. Sort of a show, a platform for 30 minutes of new idea. But note, he's done his ground research first. It's not just, I reckon, I've been thinking about this. He's got to assess the locals. So he's got the gospel, he has a story, and he has a sense of where he is. Could I have the next screen, please? Now, the place where he's invited to go is known in Greek as the Areopagus. Who's been there? Great. Just put yourself there now, Jim. Just scan from what it's like to stand there. And in English, it's sometimes known as Mars Hill. There's a very influential church named after that in, I think, Seattle recently. So it's a rough limestone outcrop, just like a piece of foamy limestone that's sort of bubbled up halfway up the hill to the Acropolis, which is the big tourist go-to, the site that still overlooks Athens today. And despite being very sort of rough, like I said, bubbly sort of limestone, it's polished smooth. And I don't know for sure, but I think for thousands of years, people have been sitting on there, moving across there. They've just human contact has smoothed it out. So in a city that cultivated philosophy as what to do, and that was before they discovered coffee, by the way, this was the place that take new ideas to and celebrate them. So there's a picture of it, a few people on it. Just that rock outcrop. You might think that's what a place to go to, present, to talk, to listen. So next screen, please. I was very pleased to get there a few months before COVID, so I just have to show you some of my pictures, don't I? And as you go there are only one set of steps up. And I can't say for sure. I don't know when they were cut. They're ancient steps. But I'm pretty sure they have been there a very long time. If it was a place that was used by people, there were steps. So St. Paul would have gone up those steps. And I was privileged to have the sense that I was walking in the footsteps of St. Paul. Next screen, please. And to the right of the steps, there's a bronze plaque in modern Greek, and it has the passage that we just heard this morning from Acts 17. It has the message. And there are some sweaty tourists standing either side of it. Now, as a preacher, I just had to note that in English, it's 270 words. This is Paul's first crack at preaching to the Gentile world in an open situation. 270 words. That's about 15% of my average length. So he was succinct. He chose his words carefully. Their attention span, this was going to matter. And it's great that we have it in the Bible today. So, next screen, please. Picture the scene. AD 31, some of the smartest minds in a very sophisticated city are there to hear this visiting Jew, this babbler. What is he going to say in a few minutes before they lose interest? No pressure. So, as I stood on the Areopagus and looked around, it occurred to me before we even get into the text that Paul started with what might be almost a joke. It's a very wry comment, given where you are. Next screen, please. So, as you look around, even today, that's looking across the limestone outcrop that the Areopagus to the Acropolis, the top of the mount, which is sort of shrine temple ground zero for Athens. It's the premier site. And the corner or the key piece in that, next screen, please, is yes, and one more. There we go. The Acropolis or the Parthenon, sorry, the Parthenon. So that is the epitome of Greek architecture, and there are all sorts of wonders with it. I hope the British give them their marbles back, which is not a joke, because all the fine sculptures of this building are in the British Museum, and they're still declining to return them. We aren't the only ones with a colonial problem. So that's the key piece, and Paul gets to look up at that. Then, if you look downwards from the Areopagus, you see the Agora. That's the one, which that's as it is today. I took that photo. That's the flat area of Athens. And again, it's still packed with ancient temples and shrines, places of worship and veneration, as well as commercial buildings and warehouses and things like that. So from the skyline, from where Paul is standing halfway up, above him, below him, what does he see? Temples, shrines. And so, with this in view, he begins his address. Men of Athens, now were women present? I don't know, but that's what's recorded. I perceive in every way you are very religious. Sort of an understatement. It's almost wall to wall. Temples and shrines. And he's reading the culture, he's reading the spiritual context that this is a city where worship and religion really matter. Why? Because the buildings tell him so. But he's seen more than these grand temples in his previous few days. And he takes opportunity to point to it. I see that you're very religious. Next screen, please. As I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with the inscription to an unknown god. And archaeology has brought several of these to light. Here's one example. They were about. So you have all these temples, all these shrines, and then you have these stones to an unknown God. How do you interpret that if you were to find that in a place? Well, that's where Paul was. Yeah, Ross. No, but they know there's something to find. And they put tremendous energy and the best energies of their engineering and their economy and everything into this. So that's the opening statement. And it leads to his point of engagement. And what Paul discerns, I think, is a nagging awareness that there's still something. There's a God beyond all those that we've named and we've carved and we've edified. There's more. When I met very kind of church-tired, secular people in Western Europe, there was a phrase that translates as, there's more between heaven and earth than meets the eye. That was often said. Non-believers, yet having this sense that we haven't quite got it. Best to keep an open mind. Now that's a little keyhole compared to this great barn door that Paul saw as he got to know Athens. Despite all the investment in connecting with the depth of existence in the spiritual world, Athens was still really searching. Hadn't nailed it. Thing to talk about over coffee. Where do you think New Zealanders, Aotearoa, where are we? Have we nailed it? Is the conversation finished? Or is there still a, I don't know, haven't quite worked it out. Don't quite know what to make of it. So Paul's message is very short. And in short, it's this. You are rightly looking for God, but you're looking in the wrong place. It's good to be looking for God. Yes, that instinct you have, that sense of needing to connect with the ground of your being, to use big language, to find the true source of the depth, but you're looking in the wrong place. So from verse 24, I proclaim to you, and here's a bullet point list, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord in heaven of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by people. Those magnificent boxes you've made with architecture that they'll be studying and marveling at in 2,000 years' time. Yes, there is a God, but not there. And certainly not in there. Don't think you can park the Almighty in a little space that you assign. Nor, verse 25, is he served by human hands as though he needs anything. Since he himself gives life and breath to all humanity and everything. Now, life and breath are a real mystery. Real mystery. And he assigns that to the divine. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, a material image formed by the art and imagination of people. Now, to make this really simple, don't look for the creator God in the creations of people. This is so Paul the Jew. This is absolutely standard Jewish engagement with the non-Jewish world. This is how they saw idolatry. So there's nothing, as it were, Christian about this yet. This is just the Jewish view on the holy, on the divine, on the God who made himself known in their history, and the inadequacy of the pagans and the other responses to that. So far, without So far, he has engaged them, complimented them. I see you're very religious. You're searching. And then he offers a critique on the inadequacy of their attempts. The most amazing architecture, sublime music, most arresting art will not reveal the living God to you. These things are not bad, but they're not God whom you seek. Now, we could do with a bit of this message today, frankly. We could do a bit of this message. Because as we've got more and more clever in making and producing, it's like the production has taken over. And this confusion has come into churchianity that somehow it's the organ, the choir, the rock band, the stage act, the liturgy, the oratory that is center stage, as if that's God. No. So personally, that's why I don't want church to be like a concert. That's why, and I haven't had to have this discussion here, but in previous times, I've had to fight with usually worship leaders and band leaders who want to be center stage. Say, no, always to one side, always off center, never sort of holding the prime attention, because we want that for God. So back to Athens. If you're looking for the living God, don't go to anything people have made or think a certain place is where you will find him. All those stunning temples bring nothing. But some of you here in Athens already sense that. There's an itch. I'm telling you something you already have worked out. So now, his development, what does he say? Where does he go to after this? His next point is that all people are made by God. All people are made by God. Beautiful. I've got a picture on my desktop of Luc Ferry. Luc Ferry is a celebrated atheist French philosopher. And like several atheist philosophers of recent times, he has come out and said, democracy would be impossible without Christianity. Yes! It's this sort of statement. We're all God's children. These are the ground convictions that underlie so much that, let's say, liberal Western life assumes. But it wasn't obvious to everybody. It's a... It comes out of the Jewish understanding and experience of God. And to quote this, he now gets really clever. And you've probably heard this before, because this is a go-to for preachers. He quotes some classic Greek poetry. So he sings their songs to make his point in their poetry, once again witnessing to what is already stirring in the cultural consciousness and a spiritual awareness. It's already there, but he's able to put a spotlight on it. And so from verse 26, next screen, please. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. And yet he is not actually far from you. And this is where he quotes two lines of classic Greek poetry, which says Paul was an educated man. In him we live and move and have our being. In him we live and move and have our being. Our life is a participation in God. All people. And again, even as some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Now, Think of your favorite rock band. Chris, keep the list short, please. Your favorite rock band, musicians or singers. Now, imagine Paul quoting lines from them and saying, it's in the songs you sing already. Do you realize that? Now, not all pop songs and rock lyrics are, as it were, holy and good. But sometimes you hear remarkable things being sung. And it witnesses to the fact that somewhere in the mix, there is a listening, a stirring, even a prophetic note that can be appealed to. And Paul, as a good evangelist, is doing that. He's finding something he can connect with, hook to. And saying to the sophisticated group, ah, some of the classic poets were already pointing to this. It's in your culture. The idea of coming in and wiping a culture out to replace it with a new one is, it's so wrong. It's so bad. I love the teaching of the Catholic Church on this out of Vatican II. Every culture has in some way anticipated a dimension of the gospel. That's awesome, isn't it? The number of times missionaries turned up. I've got a booklet at home by Don Richardson, Eternity in Their Hearts. Has anyone come across that? It was quite a bestseller. Yeah. Great read, isn't it? The number of times missionaries turned up and already in the culture was a note or an anticipation or an expectation. God, by his Spirit, was already at work before the official church arrived. Not every church is prepared to acknowledge that. Sometimes they think, no, life started when we arrived. No, the Spirit of God is preveniently at work already. So Paul's doing that and modeling that for us. You see the importance of reading the culture, of scoping the ground before you open your mouth to find these points of connection where the Spirit has already been work in the ages through cultural formats that may be totally foreign. So that's where he's got to. So you've heard that you are God's child as supported by your favorite pop song or nursery rhyme, and you're encouraged to seek this God hinted at by your own literature. Now, it's not going to be perfect theology. That's not the point. The point is there's a sweep in there that blows people in the right direction. So, meanwhile, a bit of management here. We are now 182 words into his 267-word sermon as found in the ESV. Incidentally, Megan, the battery has died in the clock here. So if I go on forever, it's a technical failure. And Paul has made 2 points without getting to Jesus. This is his big moment. He's well into his time frame, and he hasn't actually got out of the Old Testament. He's doing a standard Jewish engagement with pagan culture. And he has 84 words left. Those of you who've written essays and assignments, you know the spot you're in? Gosh, I haven't got to the main point, and I've got 84 words left. What do I do? I want to start again. Can't in this case. So let's listen to what he does and does not say now. Okay, next screen, please. The times of ignorance God overlooked. All that I've said to you, you didn't. There was ignorance in that. The ignorance of the true and unknown God being the Father of all. But now, at this point in history, he commands all people everywhere to repent because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness. Still Jewish faith, by the way. The day of the Lord. The old 8th century prophets were already talking about this. He will judge the world by a man he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Full stop. This is awesome. So I hear him saying, morality, ethics, righteousness matters. This is not a dog-eat-dog universe. Righteousness matters, and God's judgment is coming. Secondly, ignorance of God's claim on us is no longer an excuse. Ignorance is no longer an excuse. It's been tolerated, it's been forborne, but the word is out. And thirdly, there is a righteous person. There is a righteous person appointed by God, the God you seek, who has been raised from the dead, who will judge all righteousness. Now, Paul has left his big declaration, the biggie, right literally to the last phrase. He has raised him from the dead. At this point, there must have been a stir, because now he was saying something no one else ever said. This isn't sort of sophisticated, oh, that's fairly interesting stuff. What? He's raised someone from the dead. And I imagine him saying this as his time ran out. Now, if you've done much preaching, you can tell when your congregation's done with you. Sort of body language starts to sort of show, and it ripples through the pews, and you can tell time's run out. You know, I better drop this paragraph. It's not that essential anyway. I do that stuff. Otherwise, you're talking to the pillars, you know, the congregation's gone. I just imagine Paul reading his audience that day. He knew where he was at. Got to get to it. He raised him from the dead. As time ran out. Thank you, Mr. Paul from Tarsus. And now we have Sam from Siberia. No, that's sort of a situation as the next TED talk rolled on. He'd read the culture and soul of the city. He affirmed what he could. Very, very important. You go to any situation that is other, start off by affirming what you can. This is good. Yes, our scriptures testify to this. Da-da-da. He described the valid yearning for God, and he referenced and quoted back with an affirmation from their own culture. Then he'd spoken of the need to repent of their ignorance of God's before the coming judgment, and mentioned the resurrection. What had he not mentioned? Anyone who's brought an evangelistic message before, formally or informally, what had he not mentioned? The love of God, the cross of Christ, heaven and hell, the church, God's perfect plan for your life, health, wealth, and prosperity. Theo, what else has he not mentioned? Forgiveness, mercy, incarnation, sin, gifts of spirit. Okay, you see, the great grab bag, the full counsel of God, given his little time frame, what he chose to do, and where he ended. I just hold this up as an example, very helpful example of what happens when you move in freedom and keep the main thing the main thing. So that's where our readings stop today, but verse 32 goes on to tell us about the response on that day, on the Acropolis. No, the Areopagus. Verse 32, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Wow. Pull another finger. But others said, we will hear you about this again. So Paul went out from their midst, but some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus, the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. Now, this is standard response. It's what you get at Pentecost. They're drunk. No, there's something here. Every time you bring a message of depth or you witness to Jesus Christ, you get this double response. You can't say what measure, how many accept it, how many ridicule it, and how many just fell asleep somewhere in the process. But it's always the case. The parable of the sower is so apt. John, we had a few words about John Calvin yesterday. His big mystery preaching in Geneva was, how come when I preach the same message, some people are touched, convicted, and transformed, and others just go home to lunch? It's a preacher's mystery. The resurrection of the dead was the bomb. And where do you go with that? Well, you either ridicule it, or you say, I need to hear more about this. Are you around in town for a few days? Where are you staying? That sort of conversation. And I've had lots of conversations like that with people after bringing a short sharing of the gospel. So, I think you've probably got it. But I want us to capture a sense of Paul reaching his cultured pagan neighbors. We have plenty of cultured despisers of Christianity. And they're not going to be swayed by 95 decibels of Christian rock, not going to be swayed by a free lunch, etc., etc. It takes something more. It takes engagement. And I think Paul is modeling what that might look like. Understanding them, recognizing what's at hand and connecting with it. And then always the resurrection. The resurrection is the big game changer. It's the Jesus unique. It's what changed everything. And through the season of Easter, you've heard it several times. It's what took a group of dispirited, demoralized, afraid people and led them to a place where, as the Romans would say, they're turning the world upside down. And in the last 5 years, along with Luke Ferry and Tom Holland and some other historians, you've got historians are coming, non-Christian historians are coming out of the woodwork and writing wonderful work on just that process, how Christians turn the world upside down after a few centuries of being told that superstition and religion were all the source of all evil. So study the people and their context, whether that's Dunedin, your context of work, your place of study. Where are they in the question of responding to God? What witnesses to the fact that this is alive and kicking? What efforts have been made? One of the things I would say typifies our situation, our political discourse, and more, is the emphasis on right and wrong, and especially in New Zealand, helping the underdog. Those are beautiful things. But they're happening in a random, haphazard, chaotic way. But what is it underneath that? What does it matter about right and wrong, just and unjust? the weak and the helpless being championed. We take that for granted, but they are actually points of witness to the fact that we're all children of God. God is a holy God. We are wired and tuned to live with that and to flow with that. Listen for that in the songs and the poems. Listen for the yearning that leaks out. Leonid Brezhnev, man of last century, way before your time, Theo, had these fantastic eyebrows. Leader of a communist nation, in discussion one day over nuclear armament, he said, if we get it wrong, God would never forgive us. Things leak out from the most amazing places at times that witness that it's not as nailed shut as you may think. Honor that, speak to that. And whatever we may say, include the resurrection, even if it's the last sentence as we've been dragged off the stadium or the podium. Christ is risen.